Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello, good morning, everybody, and welcome to this podcast. In today's segment, we will be talking with Mr. Gary McCracken, the Vice President of Technology at a leading cybersecurity firm known as WinMagic. They're based out of Mississauga, Ontario, near Toronto. Thanks for your time, Gary. Let's go ahead and get started.
Well, great. Thanks for having me here today, Ravi.
Well, thanks for did I pronounce that correctly, or did I mangle that name of the city up there?
The name of the city is Mississauga. It's an old name.
Okay, gotcha. Okay. Well, we looked up your bio. We looked up your LinkedIn profile, searching about you on Google and your company, and you seem to have a very deep and rich background in cybersecurity. Can you tell us some of the highlights of your career and, like, what got you into cyber and, like, what your plans are made for the future?
Sure. I have been in this, for more than 30 years in data communications. And along the way, I made the transition from data communications to information security. I was about 20 years ago, I was a VP of R&D at another company in the Mississauga area, Toronto area, called Cast and Chase. And back in those days, we had this remote access product where you could, there wasn't really even much internet at that point, where you put a PCMCA modem in your laptop and you could dial in to a hardware device that we had. And the NSA actually, U.S. NSA actually contacted us and said, we like this solution you have. Could you harden it so that we could connect our remote laptops to their secret CIPRNet? CIPRNet's the secret internet protocol router network that the U.S. Department of Defense use. And so that was pretty cool. And so we spent about a year hardening our product and eventually got it certified for to protect secret information, and that was on the communication side, to dial into CIPRNet. Anyway, that's what sort of got my interest going in security, because at the time, the NSA had a lot of little things they wanted us to do to our remote access product, but they never really told us why we had to do. We just had to do what they said. And I sort of got the feeling there must be more to security than just being told what to do by the NSA to harden a product. So that's where I probably studied for my CISSP back in 2004. And, there's 10 domains of security in the CISSP, and I understand that security is a, got the understanding that security is a much broader topic than just the encryption or firewalls or any one thing. So that's sort of how I got the transition from into security from pure communications.
Okay. Now, how did you venture into WinMagic? Is this a company that you kind of helped create? Are you a partner? Can you enlighten us a little bit more on that?
Well, no, interestingly enough, when I was working, back for Cast and Chase on that remote access communication product, it solved one problem, basically that data in motion. So now military people could have these laptops and dial in the CIPRNet, but then they could download information onto their laptop, and then next thing you created a data at rest problem where they could download potentially secret information onto a laptop that wasn't protected at all. And interesting enough, there was another company down the road called WinMagic that the NSA connected us to. And WinMagic were experts in full disk encryption. And the NSA sort of orchestrated the connection of Cast and Chase with WinMagic, where Cast and Chase did the data in motion and WinMagic did the full disk encryption. And eventually, WinMagic got their full disk encryption solution also NSA certified. So then we had a complete solution where you could, for the U.S. military, where they could take the laptop. It was part of the RASPR program. We take a laptop, connect into Cipranet, get secret information down, store it on the laptop, but it was full disk encrypted, and it really made the you know, the cost of ownership of those laptops a lot less, because if you didn't have that kind of technology protecting it, literally you had to have a guy up a gun, you know, protecting that laptop when when somebody's in a hotel or traveling. And that's how I first got introduced to Win Magic, when I was at Cast and Chase, and how I met our the current founder and CEO of Win Magic, Ti Win Hoon.
Okay. Now, just to kind of step off the side here, could you explain to our audience what data in rest and what data in motion is? I don't think everybody really understands that. Could you just give a little bit of a primer into that?
Sure. In fact, there's actually sort of, you know, three general aspects of protecting data. Data in motion, data at rest, and data in use. Data at rest, I guess the prime example of that is if you take your laptop or a disk and you fill it up with data and you shut it off and put it in a drawer or put it in your laptop case, then that data is at rest. There's no there's no computer running at that time. But if you were to, say, pull a drive out of a laptop and connect it to another computer and slave it and then look at the data, you could potentially easily bypass any operating system logins or anything like that and access all the data. So there's a data at rest potential problem there, of which full disk encryption is one of the prime candidates to address that. Data in motion, on their hand, I think it's when data is moving from one computer to the other, and a nice example of that would be over the internet. And a classic way to protect data in motion when it moves over the internet is for TLS, transport layer security, or when you go onto a website and you go to that HTTPS thing, that data is going, when it goes back and forth, is most likely being encrypted with either IPsec or TLS. So that's data in motion. And then the last one is data in use. So, and maybe you could think of data use as while you're using the data, it's in the memory of your computer, it's being used, you're doing calculations on it. And that's probably the toughest thing to protect, because often the data needs to be in plain text and easily accessible when it's actually in use. But when it's traveling from one place to the other, that's motion, good thing to use TLS. And when it comes to rest, it gets stored on a disk drive or an SSD, then that's data at rest. And full disk encryption is a good technology for that.
Okay, awesome. Well, thanks for sharing that information. Now, how long has Win Magic been in business? And really, what is the whole company about? What's your niche that you specialize in?
Okay, well, we've been in business for about 22 years now. And as I mentioned before, we're headquartered in Mississauga, near the Toronto airport. And, we focus on intelligent solutions for everything encryption. So that's basically protecting focusing on protecting data at rest, as is explained, what data at rest was. So by providing full disk encryption or file encryption or other forms of data encryption, and through a history of sort of high standards and strong ethics. And I think that high standards has its roots back in those NSA days, when it was a very high standard to get something secret certified. And so we've evolved, you know, with everything encryption, the core of this is one console and one key management system that will protect and manage all these different types of encryption in different places, from multiple operating systems to IoT to servers to the cloud, all from one pane of glass with a sophisticated key management where it's just where there are policy-driven intelligence decide whether or not an end device or a user should have access to that data. So that's what we're all about. Intelligent solutions for everything encryption.
Being in business for 22 years, I'm sure that Wind Magic has had a very long history of innovation. What accomplishments are you the most proud of? Or like what projects that you have you taken part of or have even owned that you feel are like the most important to the public, to Canada, and to cybersecurity in general?
Well, I mean, I mentioned, you know, in terms of Wind Magic's accomplishments, and I can't take credit for this because I was not with Wind Magic at the time, although I worked with them. I was probably that NSA certification of the full disk encryption. And another one I really think is cool is there's you may be familiar of and heard of AES, which is the Advanced Encryption Standard, and basically that's the encryption that's the symmetric encryption that everything that it gets used pretty well everywhere. It's the standard. The NSA came up with did a competition, I don't know, many years ago, and it was what replaced the original data encryption standard. Anyway, back in the day when AES first became a standard, then there's this process of going to NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology in the U.S., to get it FIPS approved, FIPS certified. That's a Federal Information Processing Standard. This is something that would be required, say, by the U.S. government or banks and things like that. Well, we, Wind Magic, were the first ones to ever get an AES implementation certified by NIST. So we have Cert 001. Now there are hundreds of certifications, maybe even thousands of implementations of AES, but we have Cert 001. We don't use it anymore, of course, we've updated our FIPS since then, but that was sort of cool to work for a company that was right in the thick of it back in the day. I can think of some other things, too, that I've been involved in, but at least a little bit more. And
Please elaborate more.
The one that comes to mind is adding a technology called PB Connector, but what is it? Preboot networking. The issue with full disk encryption, maybe I got to take a little sideways here to explain. With full disk encryption, there's usually something called preboot authentication. That's when a separate operating system or a hunk of code runs before the entire drive is unlocked. So maybe it's a Windows machine, but even before the Windows operating system itself is decrypted, perhaps a little Linux kernel comes up, and there's preboot authentication. It could be as simple as a username and a password, or it could be a smart card. But what we did is we added networking. So when the preboot authentication comes up, it can also use the network to go to servers, to contact Active Directory, to make a very intelligent decision about whether or not the computer should even boot, whether or not Windows should even be able to be decrypted, let alone access to the data. So that was one of the main technologies that I had some involvement with here at Wind Magic that really helped move the state-of-the-art forward in the say the last 10 years. I've been with Wind Magic going on 13 years now, but that's, you know, I guess one of the things that I've really seen has made a difference.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to elaborate on, or in terms of innovation, or?
Oh, I'm probably will throw a few things in if you ask a few more questions down the road, but no. Let's move on.
Okay. Now, does Wind Magic have, are you based, I mean, you're based out of Canada, but do you have any other presence around the world, like in the United States or like that?
Yes, we do. You know, probably the bulk, well, I wouldn't say the majority or the largest hunk of our revenue probably comes from the U.S. So we have a sales and sales engineering presence in the U.S., but also Germany. For Europe and Japan. It's interesting that our Japanese team, we have about a half a dozen or more, is one of our most established teams, and they've been established for maybe more over 10 years in the Japanese market. And it's sort of cool when I see our Japanese team, you know, come to the Toronto for a get-together with us here at headquarters, just to see how I don't know how professional they are and how well they have done on the other side of the world with full subscription. At one time, and it may still be true, they had one of the highest market shares for encryption in Japan.
Okay, wow. Now, who is your typical customer base? Is it maybe the mom-to-pop stores like the SMBs, or is it the Fortune 500, or perhaps a mixture of both? And what kind of industries are your niche industries? What do you like to focus on the most?
Well, we've had we're not a consumer business, so we are businesses. We are business-oriented. And we have a client-server architecture. And so when you start to have more than 10, 20, or say more than 50 users in an enterprise, and they're encrypting, and they have keys to be managed, then they really need a key management system like our SecureDoc Enterprise. So we can go from about 50 users at the low end, and at the highest end, it's been up to, we have customers at over 100,000 seats. So there's a wide range of customers that use our products. I would say our sweet spot, though, is probably medium-sized businesses, 1 to 2,000 users.
Okay.
And then
okay.
In terms of verticals, I think you asked, what are type of customers? So these, of course, can be globally. Well, this started out, first of all, if I've been in it long enough that at a time that nobody did care, not many people other than just governments cared about protecting their data at rest. And, that's 20 years ago or so. So governments are still one of our most major customers. Governments and then government-like organizations like police forces. But it's expanded into financial, banks and credit card companies. Health is also the whole sector is very concerned about personal information and education. So while it could be used anywhere, areas that are more concerned about compliance and security and where a breach would really hurt their customers or endpoints, those are the sectors that care most.
Okay. Now, speaking of which, all this data, concerns and data privacy, data protection, there's a plethora of new legislations that have come out in the last couple of years. Of course, there's the HIPAA, that came out mid-90s, then GDPR just came out a couple of years ago. And just recently, the California Consumer Privacy Act, or CCPA, just came out, I believe, it was just a couple of weeks ago, if I'm correct. Have any of these legislations have an impact on your customers? And if so, can you say, in general, what's happened and how you help them come to compliance? Or do you take a proactive stance and try to have them come to compliance to begin with so they're not audited?
Yeah, so for sure. The CCPA, the California Consumer Privacy Act, is just, one of the latest in a series of compliance regulations that have come out over the years. And so it's starting to have an impact already. But, the one that really sort of was the tipping point in terms of privacy was GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation for Europe. But it basically, any company that works internationally has some kind of operations in Europe. And so it really has been impacting companies, in all parts of the world, not just Europe, but also in the United States and Canada for sure. And, even our company, just internally, just how here we are in Canada, just how we manage the information of our employees and our customers, we're making an effort to look at compliance with GDPR, even though we have no legal actual requirement to do so. So it's had an impact across the board. Of course, privacy and security are a little different, but you really can't have proper privacy if you don't have control of the data, and that's where technologies like cryptography encryption come to play. So a lot of them, like, okay, you mentioned HIPAA or PCI DSS, the Payment Card Industry Data Security Standard. They all have sections in there about properly protecting the data or obfuscating the data, and they all have a pretty strong recommendation, although they might, some don't may not actually write in there that you're required that to encrypt it. And if you aren't encrypting it, it makes it a lot harder to defend in an audit how you're actually protecting it. And something like PCI DSS, if you could potentially lose your right to process credit cards if you can't maintain compliance with that. And then HIPAA could be much, much worse. So many of our customers are very interested in compliance, I hate to say versus security, but as well as security. Compliance and security are being the two driving forces for wanting to protect data at rest.
Sure. Now, kind of side question, do you offer consulting services? Do you do like risk assessments or like calculating like how much risk one thing is versus another for a company to help them come into compliance before they, so that they will not become a target of an audit?
We don't offer consultancy, and we're also very careful not to say, oh, just if you just encrypt your data, then you'll be, you know, GDPR compliant, because we have a understanding that, you know, any of these regulations have many, many aspects to them. They have people and process and technology aspects to it. There's privacy, many, many different aspects. So what we can do is when our sales engineers engage with a customer, we can help them with information on how to mitigate the risks that they identify. I'm a very strong believer in a risk assessment is the best way for a company to start. Let's take a look at what the impact would be if you would have a breach, and then take a look at the probability that there might be an impact, and do a calculation based on that on what the risk would be. And if the risk is, you know, high or very high, then that company needs to look at mitigations. And often one of the most cost-effective and baseline mitigations is encryption. It's a very good starting point. It's not the only tool to meet compliance by far, but it is sort of one of the baseline technologies.
Okay. Just an off-the-cuff question also. Is there are there a lot of, like, encryption, you know, mathematical algorithms? And I'm kind of more of a theoretical guy. Does WinMagic have, like, a favorite encryption algorithm that you maybe make more use of, like RSA or Diffie-Hellman key exchange or elliptical wave theory? I know I'm getting off on the deep end here, but is there a certain, like, mathematical algorithm that you really like and kind of support?
Well, I guess as mentioned before, there's two basic for encryption, two basic categories. There is symmetric encryption algorithms and asymmetric encryption algorithms. So a symmetric encryption algorithm is where you use the same key to encrypt it as you use to decrypt it, and that's used for bulk encryption, encrypting vast amounts of data at a time. And by far, the world standard for that is the AES, Advanced Encryption Standard. Everybody uses that. The only place that it may not be used might be by a national security agency that have developed some other proprietary algorithm that we may not even be told what the name of it is. But by far, the most accepted encryption algorithm is AES. Then there's the other side, the asymmetric side. That's where you use a different key to encrypt than you use to decrypt. And that's the kind of algorithm you need to use for key exchange. The two that come to mind are RSA, And I think you mentioned elliptic curve. RSA is something that comes into play quite often when we use it. An elliptic curve has potentially some computational advantages where you can get stronger encryption for less computation. But they both are good to use for that asymmetric key, well, I want to say key exchange, but non-bulk encryption. So, and when it comes right down to it, when we get our cryptographic engine, FIPS approved itself, that's a Federal Information Processing Standard, there are a number of algorithms that are eligible to be FIPS approved, and there are, and you just can't pick one that isn't already on the list for NIST and throw it in there. So we carefully select the algorithms that are always FIPS approvable. So it's our basic product, full-disk encryption, it doesn't have is always running in FIPS mode. There isn't any way that you can that you configure it to take it out of FIPS mode. So you can always be confident that if you're in compliance, if you're say in the U.S. government or the Canadian government or any other place that requires that sort of a higher standard.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, you had mentioned about a new product for the small medium-sized business client. Can you tell us more about that, please?
Yeah. I rambled on a little bit. I said, well, how we could go to smaller customers, and we had larger customers and some really large customers. But our sweet spot is, you know, for our full enterprise system is 1,000 to 2,000 to 3,000 or, you know, or above. And we saw a need in the SMB market or the smaller customer market where for customers that have 50 or more users, may not have much of an IT department at all, and certainly don't have a lot of extra IT resources to be running a large system that you might need in a bank that is 2 or 10,000 people. So we came up. The other thing that we looked at was, and maybe I'll get a chance to explain this later, but we can provide our own encryption, as I talked, with using AES, but our key management system also allows us to self-encrypting drives, and native encryption built into operating system, whether that's File Vault 2, which is built into the Mac, or DMCrypt, which is built into Linux, or BitLocker, which is part of Windows. So anyway, our new product is just for the Windows people. It's called Bitmana, and it manages BitLocker for smaller customers that have decided to use the BitLocker encryption and an engine that's built into Windows 10. It's a good choice for underlying FTE encryption engine because they can get it with the operating system. And it's got a high degree of compatibility with Microsoft because it's from Microsoft and with new hardware. The thing with BitLocker, it being a good encryption engine, on its own, it's not a managed product. So you need something to manage it. For instance, if the user forgets their PIN, then they need to be able to recover that computer. If they don't, then they've got an encrypted computer, and all their data is locked and lost forever if they forget their PIN. And in an enterprise, or maybe he doesn't forget that PIN, maybe that him or her have left the company, and the company wants to get that data off that laptop because it was important. So that's where something like Bitmana comes in, where it stores those encryption keys in the central server and does things like recovery for forensics or password recovery. And what we've done is We've selected a few of the key features of our main enterprise product and packaged them into this Bitmana for the SMB market so they can sort of enjoy the features, that some of these more advanced features that they hadn't been available to the small SMB before. I'll give a couple examples here. In security, we have something called BitLocker Tamper Protection. So while you could use BitLocker to encrypt your information, there's a number of different ways where users could turn that encryption off, either automatically or suspend it. Either manually or be suspended automatically. And that's the problem, because if that computer's encryption gets turned off and then gets stolen, then you've lost protection and you could be in big trouble with the auditors. So we have this this feature called tamper protection, which will actually prevent users, even if they are an administrator on their own machine, from turning off that encryption unless the central administrator of Bitmana gives them that privilege. So we've taken there is a bunch more. I won't go through them all, but there's a bunch of features in this in Bitmana that really sort of ups the manageability and security of BitLocker itself. So I think it's going to be well received. I'm probably the first time I'm talking about it publicly now, and we're starting to roll it out this quarter.
Okay, that's awesome. Now, you have another product, I believe, called Everything Encryption. Could you go into that into a little bit more detail, and what business problems does it solve, and how is it available?
Sure. So Everything Encryption is sort of our catchphrase, right?
Right.
By Everything Encryption, our focus really is much, much more on data at rest as opposed to that, data in motion encryption. Maybe the best way to do is talk about a few of our business challenges that we solve and look at those in terms of, and then maybe point out some of the products that we have for those. The biggest sort of business problem when an enterprise starts to get, they'll have some Macs and they'll have some Linux and they'll have Windows and they'll maybe have some data virtual machines in their data center, and maybe they're starting to move to the cloud. There gets to be many, many different kind of siloed security solutions if you use some special thing for Mac and some special thing for Windows, something for Linux. So we have something called Enterprise SecureDoc Enterprise Server, and this is the one server that manages the entire ecosystem of data at rest solutions. And everything else I'm going to talk about all hooks up into that one overarching SecureDoc Enterprise Server. Let me pick another couple examples. I mentioned these, but I'll go a little more depth. Self-encrypting drives. A self-encrypting drive is a drive itself that does, as the name suggests, that does the encryption. So this is can be done very, very efficiently right in the silicon of the drive. And almost nowadays, most new SSDs, which are very fast, can encrypt at line, at wire speed. And there's an advantage to using self-encrypting drives over software encryption in that it can keep up to the 100% performance of the drive and no performance degradation. And we've been a member of the Trusted Computing Group for more than 10 years. I personally have been a member of the Trusted Computing Group for more than 10 years and have a SED management program where we deal with pretty well all the drive manufacturers in the market in certifying their drives as compatible with our SecureDoc Opal management system. So that's an example of a company or of a technology that I think will be growing in prevalence in the future, especially as the hardware gets faster and faster, and you know software encryption, software solutions may have trouble keeping up with the performance levels that can come in hardware. But we also, you know, I'll skip through some more here. We also have SecureDoc file encryption, and that's something that makes sense when you layer it on top of full description. You can use it to protect file servers and network shares, or even locally for separation of duties, so that some people on a machine can see files and others can't. But a good one is, but you probably haven't mentioned, is USBs. It's been a historic problem where, you know, those little flash drives where you can copy information onto them and then put it in your shirt pocket or lose it. And if you happen to copy any kind of confidential information on that and it gets lost, it's a serious a compliance breach, plus also obviously a security breach. So within our key management, again, all under the management of the SecureDoc Enterprise server, we can, with this USB memory encryption, we can have it automatically encrypt. So you plug a USB into your drive, into your computer, copy data onto it, it's automatically encrypted. No passwords, you would nothing. And then you move it to another computer inside your organization, and if it has, that other computer has the key, then it will access the data completely transparently, and the user would never even have known that it was encrypted. However, if a third party picks that USB memory stick up off the street, they won't have the key, and the USB memory stick will look like total random data. So that's a very good solution for any company that uses USB memory sticks. And surprisingly, there's still quite a few still use them. So FileVault 2 for Mac, SD Linux. We have the only SecureDoc Linux. We have the only, well, we believe we have the only enterprise manageable Linux product. Quite often the issue is the actual encryption on any of these platforms, the actual AES, is pretty much a commodity. What's the hard part is automating it and the key management and being able to recover. And that's what we've brought to Linux. So we actually take advantage of the built-in encryption based in Linux, but we can do some things that other people can't do. That includes converting or encrypting a live Linux machine and encrypting the data on the fly as it's running. Very, very handy for legacy servers or something that you can't afford to take offline for a day or two to encrypt. So
excellent.
Some of those technologies I mentioned there are on a little bit more on the endpoint, but WinMagic, as I technologies actually go from the endpoint to the data center to the cloud. So looking at the cloud side of things, and this is where the future is. I see a lot of businesses moving their data to the cloud. It might take them a while, and there are some legitimate control issues with moving to the cloud, but I think that's where it'll end up. And so then you end up things like running your virtual machines inside Azure or AWS. And we have a solution called CloudVM where we encrypt inside that cloud, whether it's Windows or Linux, or VDI, virtual desktop. So I don't think I probably mentioned them all, but there is a wide set. Yeah, there's a wide set of products that all focus on protecting data at rest and all under that umbrella of manageability by that SecureDoc Enterprise server. Those, again, they exist today.
Are there any customer success stories you'd like to share with us, any client testimonials about your product?
Yeah. Some customers, because of the security nature, don't like to be named. Some will allow us. But there's one that comes to the mind is in the legal, and I don't even think I mentioned legal as being a vertical, but because I guess I missed it. But you can imagine there's a fair amount of concern about confidentiality and compliance in the legal, on the legal side of things. Well, there's a firm that we've been working with, NCCL, 600 attorneys, about 900 employees, and with many different branches. And they were facing an environment, where 25% of the law firms were reporting a data breach each year. This was some back in 2015. And an environment where clients were asking an audit, a security audit of their law firms, or 15% of law firms have been asked for an audit. And there were lots of breach incident types. You know, the top three breach incident types: the lost or theft of a laptop or a USB drive, or a tablet or a smartphone was one of the top three. There were other ones too: spear phishing, of course. Encryption doesn't, and cryptography doesn't help as much with spear phishing as other technologies and training. That's why security is a full-faceted, a multifaceted approach. But certainly one of the top ones was lost or theft of a laptop. So, and they had USBs. The other thing was that they had wanted the performance of self-encrypting drives. So they deployed SecureDoc with the our OPAL management and with our automatic USB flash drive encryption. So that gave them data rest protection on their laptops, as well as on their portable data. And
cool.
The other thing that on some of the machines were so the need for security was so important. It's such confidential data. But they wanted the ability to have multi-factor authentication at pre-boot. And what we could do is we could support their smart card. So a smart card is a device that they can plug into the laptop before the operating system, before Windows even boots up, and then authenticate to the smart card and then boot up. So that's the smart card was probably one of the key technologies that we brought to the table that you really can't get with, BitLocker alone, who doesn't really have much of a doesn't have any much of a multi-factor authentication support for smart cards at all. So that's one example of a particular customer and in a particular vertical that used some of our basic components that I mentioned before of our products, including OPAL management, self-encrypting drive, and removal media, and that multi-factor authentication at pre-boot.
Sure. Excellent. Now, Gary, obviously, there are tons of cybersecurity vendors, in Canada, the United States, even worldwide. Why should a customer come and say, why should they come to you and say, hey, Gary, I want to work with you as opposed to all these other companies? What separates you from the other vendors in this market space that you have?
Well, the core of it is, our high standards and strong ethics and our concentration and focus, unaltering focus the last 20 years on protecting data at rest. So we have the most comprehensive solution that exists in the market for protecting data rest. I mentioned all the different areas from endpoint to the cloud and in between. So if there isn't something that we do today, it's likely, and it becomes a threat emerges, then we'll be on it. Or if a new technology emerges, we'll be on it. And you don't get that when you go to, a large, antivirus company who only have a tenth of the comprehensive solutions that we have, and that sort of take what you get. We're a company that, I guess in a way, future-proofs you from a security perspective with data at rest because of our expertise.
Okay. Now, what kind of problems is WinMagic going to work on for the future? Do you have any plans for expansion in that regards? If you're able to say so, could you give us some insight?
Well, yeah, some of our, you know, some of the technologies or projects that we're working on now that aren't, you know, aren't available for sale. In fact, you know, but they're one of these things that sort of help you future-proof yourself. As the world progresses, are, well, let me mention the cloud. So a lot of companies have moved to the cloud or thinking about moving to cloud, and there's, of course, there's different modes and models to move to the cloud. But one model is to move, it's called infrastructure as a service, running your virtual machine inside Microsoft's Azure or AWS's or Amazon's AWS cloud, and taking advantage of their infrastructure and then running your data and running your workloads in the cloud. It's good, but there's a bit of a problem about control. If you just throw it up in a cloud, and even if they're encrypting it, you can't be. The question you have to ask is, who has the key? And if you throw it up and say, you know, AWS, who has access to that key? In the end, the I believe AWS has the key because they do the encryption inside their infrastructure, inside their hypervisor. So our solution is to do what we call in-guest encryption, where inside the inside the cloud, inside the virtual machine, the encryption is done, and the key part here is it's done under the control of the enterprise, under the control of the user, the owner of the data, not the cloud service provider. And this new technology that we're working with AMD is called SCV, Secure Encrypted Virtualization. AMD has developed a hardware technology where it encrypts the memory of the virtual machine, so that's data in use, and it protects and it encrypts the memory in such a way that not even the cloud service provider, whoever that may be, can peek in and get at that data. So what we're working on is we're combining that hardware protection for data in use with the full disk encryption for protection of data at rest that we provide into a very hardened solution for protecting workloads or secure workloads. And I think that technology, when it finally comes to when it comes to the market and becomes generally available, is going to be a real tipping point for the rest of the enterprises and governments and so forth that want to move to the cloud for all the vast benefits of the cloud, but are just a little reluctant to do at this point because they don't want to give up the control of their data to a cloud service provider, whether it be Google or Microsoft or whoever. So that's one of our most exciting ones. But another one that what we call Beyond SE, Beyond Crypto Engineering, is to be able to share information with anybody in the world without having to put a password on an encrypted file and send them the password without having to prearrange that exchange of data. And there's an underlying, we talked a little bit earlier, there's an underlying technology, this symmetric or asymmetric encryption where there's these public and private keys. And I'm sure you've heard of PKI, and PKI has been around for 20 years. It's always had the promise of great promise, but it's not quite, it always is a little hard to run, a little hard to maintain, a little hard to trust. This isn't something that we're doing ourselves, but the industry, people like Microsoft and other very big players are working on something called decentralized PKI, and it's based on top of blockchain, of all things. And the idea here is that with things like called resolvers, that applications will be able to hook in to these blockchains of distributed decentralized PKI and be able to find the public key of the target you want to send the information to. So in a perfect world, sometime in the future, if I want to send you an encrypted file or encrypted information, I'll just hook into this blockchain through this distributed PKI to your DID, your decentralized identity. I'll be able to grab your public key. I'll use be able to asymmetric encryption to encrypt your data and send something to you, and the only person in the world that can decrypt it is you. That might take a little while. I think it's now become possible with the advent of and popularity of blockchain itself. So I know sometimes people talk about blockchain as they overblow what possibilities blockchain can do, but I think that there is a good foundational technology, and we'll build some of our products on top of that, and that file distribution that Beyonce product has talked about. So there's a few that we're working on. You can see that container encryption for the cloud. You see that we've our R&D department is on the edge of some of these new technologies.
Excellent. Sounds really fascinating. Now, as we come close, as we're now approaching our last part of the show here, I just kind of want to talk about the this is cybersecurity threat landscape in general. I kind of save this part for last for all of my guests. We all keep hearing about this thing called the Internet of Things, or IoT, where everything's all connected together. I find that to be a very scary proposition. So just increase the attack surface for the cyber attacker. What are your thoughts on the IoT? Has WinMagic done any work in that area?
So, yes, we have. And what you might think of as sort of an old world IoT thing, because, what is IoT, Internet of Things, but an IoT device basically has to come up and boot up on itself without any user present. It's not like a laptop or something that, a user's present, they type in username and password. But an IoT device boots up and starts operating after a power failure and operates on its own. And an example of a device like that is actually an ATM. When an ATM is out in the field, when it boots up after a power failure or whatever, there is no tech there to type in a username or password. And this device, but the ATM needs to boot up, and then it needs to very quickly get into the mode of being able to service customers. Of course, the other thing of another basic part of IoT is that it's got to have access to the Internet or to a network. So an ATM is actually something that fits that bill more on the high-value side, and we've been working with NCR, used to be called National Cash Register, one of the largest suppliers of ATMs, and we're their supplier for their full disk encryption for data at risk. And we use some of those technologies that I mentioned before. We use that pre-boot connectivity, that pre-boot PV connects, where when the ATM comes up, it can actually connect out over the network to a secure central server, our SecureDock Enterprise server, which can make an intelligent decision whether or not to provide the ATM the key required for it to boot up and operate. So for those higher value systems, anything that has potential confidential information on them, we believe that should, again, encryption is a foundational technology, cryptology is a foundational technology, we believe it should be encrypted. And doing the authentication and the key management over the network when it's an IoT device makes perfect sense. So as devices, any device that has confidential information potentially stored on it probably should be encrypted, and it probably should and could do its an authentication over the Internet to a secure server. That may not apply to every little consumer device you have in your house, but if it's an ATM or it's a sensor on a bridge or infrastructure, it needs to be protected because we could find ourselves open to state-sponsored attacks in the future unless we do.
Okay. Another area of cybersecurity that's going to get another lot of attention is cybersecurity risk insurance policies. With your work in data privacy and all that, have you come across any clients that express concerns about getting a cybersecurity insurance policy or anything remotely like that?
Yeah, well, yes. I mean, it has been a topic of conversation. In fact, we've talked to even our insurance company here, and what we would like to do is get to the point where you could actually get a specific discount for having the proper technologies in place, like, for instance, having full disk encryption in place. Just like here in Ontario, I get a 5% discount if I have snow tires on my car because it reduces the risk of an accident. I don't know if it's 5% or not, but I get a 5% discount. We'd like to get to the point where we could actually quantify what the discount would be. And then that would encourage companies to be more proactive. And the insurance companies are often the most active and almost surprisingly active, even in brand new technologies, and looking out to even 10 to 20 years on how to assess risk.
Okay, excellent. Now, on another question here, here in the United States, we've got our 2020 presidential elections coming up, and there's a whole plethora of cybersecurity issues, especially with encryption. A big issue here in the United States, that of deepfakes using AI, artificial intelligence, machine learning, neural networks to create replicas of real people. And it looks like almost the real thing. To a trained eye, you can probably notice the differences, but to a average person, they may not be able to see it. And this can be easily used for, phishing campaigns, giving, donations that's going to go to like an offshore bank account in China or something. Has Wood Magic done any work with AI or machine learning in trying to combat this new thing called deepfakes?
No, we haven't. That's a little bit of out of our bailiwick.
Okay.
And I don't know. I'm not even sure. Well, I mean, I guess you can have deep fake detection software running on your endpoint. It's not something that we're working on. But there's also a people aspect to these things. And unfortunately, the people aspect is going to be you really can't trust anything you read or now see anymore. And you always have to question it and you'll always have to verify it. And that's getting a little sad because it's sort of like the equivalent of a spam now or phishing. When you get an email that you used to be, but appears to come from your bank, you 15 years ago, you probably would have, trusted that was from your bank and acted upon it now. Now, basically, almost everything you receive or everything I receive, I assume I'm being attacked, and that's really sort of sad when everything I now view, I'm going to have to question whether or not it's real or not. It's not something I've got a solution for, though.
Right. Unfortunately, that's what's kind of becoming too, because I almost fell victim to a phishing attack with PayPal last December, actually, but luckily that didn't happen. I mean, it's just amazing. I mean, even the PayPals, your banking websites, everything just looks so real when they could be spoofed. Now, one more hot button topic. Here in the United States, I'm not sure if it's the same in Canada, but the C-suite is being on the hot button, on the hot seat for being held more accountable for, cyber threats, and any cyber attacks that occur. And, they're being held more accountable by the board of directors. Do you see that same thing happening in Canada? I mean, what are your thoughts on that? Because my view is, I don't think that the CISO or the CIO's head should roll immediately after cyber attack. You need to kind of do a in-depth investigation, kind of see where things happened, and then kind of, blame fault from there. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I think it's global, but you know, it's two threat. I mean, it's, you know, we as you mentioned, you know, after there's been an attack, then whose head's going to roll and things like that. The interesting about, for instance, GDPR, it's GDPR isn't is about compliance. So you can get as in much trouble for being non-compliant and not have having a breach than you have if you have a breach. In fact, if you have a breach with GDPR and you have put in all the proper, you know, mitigations and you made a, you know, a good effort all around and very competent, then the fact that you had a breach is just like some criminal attacked you and you should almost be felt sorry for as a corporation. So, as and as a CEO, it shouldn't be all around there's a breach and then we're going to go see if heads are rolls. It should be before there's a breach, we should put in, do a proper risk assessment and proper mitigations in place. And if you do that, then you're protected against losing your head next if you do actually have a breach.
Okay. Now, projecting the long term, how do you think the cybersecurity threat landscape is going to unfold this year and maybe even into this decade? And what do you think that number one cyber threat is going to be? Is it going to be ransomware, phishing, crypto jacking, crypto mining? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, certainly ransomware right now seems to be, you know, top of, you know, all the things I read to come in here. Every, you know, seems two out of five articles I read are about some kind of ransomware attack. But I think that should be able to be addressed if, you know, first of all, your best protection against a ransomware attack is, well, proper IT and have backed up your information and test your backups and so forth. Plus, I read that the number one attack vector for ransomware was RDP, Remote Desktop Protocol, being open to the internet. Well, that's like nobody says that's a good thing to do. So I think that there's some relatively simple things that that companies and it seems municipalities are also seem to be hit with ransomware can do to get that threat under control. So I don't think it's going to be ransomware moving forward. And it's hard to predict what the next thing is, but people and you know, this phishing thing, I think that's probably the going to be the hardest thing that we can do, because it's while we can fix technology one at a time, it's harder to get people to be trained to be able to make proper decisions, whether or not, as you just mentioned before, whether it's a deep fake or not. So that may very well be the next area in the next year or two. But you know, longer term, a couple things on my radar are, well, one is this quantum computing, and I had the pleasure of going to a NIST conference a couple of years ago, the International Cryptographic Module Conference. And that's a fairly technical thing, but essentially they talk about which kind of algorithms go into cryptographic modules and how they're verified and things like that. I was surprised when I was there. There was a whole track on quantum computing and how to make quantum-resistant algorithms. And there is a very real, you know, a fear that sometime in the next little while, and you know, when I was at RSA, there was a session on quantum computing that was led by a University of Waterloo professor that said there's probably a 50% probability that this asymmetric encryption that we've been talking about, this RSA or elliptical curve, will be broken or whatever you want to put it, not provide the protection that it does now within 14 years. And there's so much of the world's information, especially that data in motion that's protected with those kind of algorithms. I think it's something that really could stir up a lot of trouble on the horizon of 10 to 20 years. The other thing that longer term is AI. AI, with AI, as you know, with their learning algorithms, and as the sophistication happens with AI, then your creations end up making decisions based on so much information that's incomprehensible for any particular person to figure out to control that. And so then you get biases built into the AI. Well, what happens if somehow in that information an attacker can bias the AI in a way that even the creator of the AI doesn't understand? Combine that running on a quantum computer, and you could have programs you don't understand running on computers we don't understand. And that sort of bodes well for the security industry anyway, because I think that there may be some 20 years from now, some, you know, AI anti-malware companies that might be the biggest thing out there.
Okay. Finally, Gary, as you wrap up our show, I kind of say the best for last. Do you have a laundry list of tips or best practices that you normally tell customers or even friends, family, what they can do to mitigate the risk of being a victim of cyber attack? I mean, we cannot avoid 100% from being a victim, but we can definitely lessen the statistical odds of it. What do you tell people normally?
Well, in our personal world, I think these phishing attacks are probably the most dangerous. And I just tell people, unfortunately, assume it's a phishing attack, and ignore it. Don't look in your junk mail and try to determine if the things in your junk mail are phishing attacks, because the probability is that they are is like 95%. So ignore them. And even if a legitimate company, and I've had this happen a couple times, a legitimate bank, whether they call you or they send you something, and say they're your bank, and even if they are your bank, if anybody approaches you in a way that's similar to a phishing attack, it's their fault, not yours. It's their fault that they're behaving in a way that could be confused with a phishing attack. So ignore them too. Make them send you a registered letter in the mail or something. So that seems to be whether that's people or whether that's even corporations. Be very suspicious of anything you receive, and if it looks suspicious, even if it's legitimate, it's not your fault, because people should be not sending you things that can be confused with phishing. And then I have to give protect your data at rest, and cryptography and encryption, that it won't solve all the world's security problems, but it is a foundational technology. And if your information is encrypted with a properly managed key or even a password at home, and somebody steals your laptop or your device, whatever, then you're going to put yourself beyond the resources and the determination of any kind of average attacker. So, I mean, there's some fundamental, simple things you can do to protect yourself, and I think that's one of them too.
Okay. Well, Gary, we thank you for your time this afternoon. It's been a very insightful, a lot of great content here about encryption, cryptography, and what you guys do here at WinMagic. We thank you for your time, and we look forward to having you on another podcast, hopefully this quarter.
Well, thanks very much for inviting me, and I enjoyed our conversation today.
Thanks. Have a great day.
Okay. Goodbye.
Bye.